Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Deadline City. We are your hosts, Zoraida Cordova.
And Danielle Clayton.
And today we have an extremely special guest, Miss V.E. Schwab. Ooh. You might know her from such books as The Darker Shade.
How dare you?
Damn it.
Rude.
A Darker Shade of Magic.
So rude. It's because we were talking about A Darker Shade of Dicks, and now you can't remember the title.
Because you're a dirty bird.
I'm going to leave that in there.
Don't you dare.
Yes, I will. One of the most prolific authors that we know. Thank you so much for being here. And today we're going to the destination.
Villaintown.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to
talk. Villain Mansion.
Yeah.
Right? Villains
more of a mansion.
Should have a mansion.
Villains would absolutely
or
have a mansion.
Right.
Ooh,
or a metropolis.
Ooh, metropolis.
Yes, they would have a metropolis. And I feel like you create some of the best villains in town.
Why, thank you.
And I like your villains so much that I'm willing to sort of like forego your heroes to be with your villains. And so that's why I wanted to talk to you about this, because I want to talk about what makes for a good villain. I've never been excited by villains like Voldemort, because he wants to live forever, but why?
Well, I always
say, why would you want to live forever when you have a snake nose?
You're
okay.
Rude.
Well, I always say it's the difference between big evils and small evils. Like, Voldemort is not somebody we can relate to, because most of us don't have this like drive for world domination. But
you do.
I know. I said most. But Dolores Umbridge is a far scarier villain in the course of that series, because she's the kind of small evil that we absolutely have known before. We've all met somebody like Dolores Umbridge. And I think that's something that I respond to generally in my works and in the works of others, is the idea of really grounded villainy, whether it's jealousy, whether it's covetousness, whether it's pride, really kind of leaning into very human flaws for my villains.
And Dolores is terrifying because she could also, like, be my grandmother.
Oh, yeah.
She has all of the qualities of a regular sort of older lady, where you're like, oh, you're just conservative. Oh, you just believe in manners.
Yeah.
And then, no, you're awful. But then I love, like, Bellatrix.
Yeah.
Because she's just
unwieldy.
Okay, but that's the opposite end of the grounded villainy spectrum,
right.
Is the character. Well, it's the character that allows us to act out through an avatar.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like as women, we have always felt those microaggressions and wish that we could respond with a kind of chaos. You know, women are told to be very contained, very polite, and very proper. And to see a character like Bellatrix that kind of just gives in to chaos in that way is really freeing. Yeah, it's really freeing to live through.
I love her, even though she's awful.
I love her,
and she hurt one of my favorite characters. But I just...
She hurt a lot of people.
I know, but, like, Sirius Black is, like, my love.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if I could be with any fictional character, it would be with him. I just love him so much. But I have to hate her for that. But she was such a seductive character.
Absolutely.
And
villainy is seductive.
Yes, and so I like villains more than I like heroes, which makes me a monster.
I think it just pushes us to make our heroes a little bit more interesting. I think heroes can fall, and that's where their interest is, and villains can rise. And I think it's interesting, that gap between the two, where they can meet. Where, I mean, I remember growing up on something like Smallville.
Yeah.
How much I love the episodes where Clark Kent found red kryptonite.
Yes.
Like, we want something different from our heroes and our villains. I think it's not very interesting when the heroes have nowhere to go.
Right.
So we have to believe that they can go down. And with villains, we should always feel a little uncertain about their ability to go up.
Right. And I like villains who have really good reasons for being bad.
Right.
Because I think that that makes me feel like, oh, I could actually be seduced.
Exactly.
I have reasons for being bad, too.
I want to join the dark side.
I want to join the dark side.
Right.
And it's funny, I had this feeling when, I know these movies, people are controversial about them, but when I was watching the second Fantastic Beasts, I thought, oh, shoot, I would join the cult. Johnny Depp.
Absolutely.
And I know we don't like him, but... I would have probably been seduced by Grindelwald.
Grindelwald, yeah.
And I had to face that of, like, why?
Mm-hmm. I had that
because
moment.
He wasn't wrong.
I had that moment with Magneto.
Yeah. Oh,
when we meet
that.
Magneto.
I would have been on Magneto's team a whole bunch.
Yeah.
Also, it's Michael Fassbender who's
hot. Yes, I know.
I love James McAvoy so much and his beautiful Scottish brogue. But
I'm going Fassbender. I'm team
Fassbender.
But
I would
Magneto.
Be Fassbender because he's like, listen, humans are treating us like shit. We have to protect ourselves. We are.
I love
we are
a good
mutants.
He also has every right
Absolutely.
To be angry.
Exactly. He has an origin story which leads to a believable kind of villainy. Those are my absolute favorites.
And I'm excited to see Joker.
I'm nervous. Can I tell you why I'm nervous?
Because
I feel like it's the wrong time, and I love Joker. Like, you guys know that I love Joker, but I wish that this movie had come out either 6 years ago or a few years from now. I feel like there's such a risk that it's going to be used as kind of a manifesto for young white men who feel othered, which is, you know,
we need to talk about Kevin.
Very, very much. We need to talk about Kevin. And the fact is, like, this franchise does not have the greatest legacy when it comes to speaking to young white men. I feel like, and I just think the messages which are in it, there's a risk there that makes me sad, because I'm very excited to see this movie and I don't feel safe going to see it in a movie theater.
And they've been talking about that on the news a lot, how they're banning people from wearing face paint and banning people from wearing masks and inhabiting the villain's
look. Well, but also the director's not taking a whole lot of responsibility for it. And I think, you know, I was just in Hollywood and this conversation comes up a lot about responsibility, because when it's inconvenient, we say, oh, we just tell stories. And when it's convenient, we say we change minds and we shape worlds. And the fact is that everything that we do creates a message.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about the message in the Joker which makes me viscerally uncomfortable. And I'm not saying that discomfort is a bad thing, but it's impossible to dissociate that from the world in which we live right now.
Right. It's almost too close.
It's way too close.
And when
right
we think
now.
About creating villains and how we create villains, thinking about that messaging is important, because I do love Joker, and
me
I
too.
Love him for a lot of different reasons. And I love Joaquin Phoenix. Well,
mm-hmm.
I want to see what he does, because Heath Ledger's Joker
of course.
Is my greatest
seminal.
Love.
Absolutely.
It's
seminal
work. It's beautiful. It's
the Joker
I love
in the TV show in Gotham, the
yes.
TV show, is incredible.
Cameron Monaghan's
right.
character
he's so
is amazing.
Good. And he's terrifying.
Terrifying.
Okay, there's a moment in that show, and I have, like, played it back so many times, where he has the handgun and he's playing Russian roulette,
mm-hmm.
and he's explaining the difference between, like, the brave and the bold and the mad, and he like pulls the trigger multiple times. He pulls it 3 times in a row to prove a point that he's the right person. It is one of the most chilling and believable monologues, and I was sold from that moment.
Beautiful writing.
Oh, the writing for his character specifically on that show was spectacular.
Mm-hmm. And it shows you what acting can do.
Ugh,
because
yeah.
the Joker is a character that you have to get right. It's a villain that you have to get
yeah.
right.
I mean, we've seen it portrayed by a lot of people at this point.
And there are only a few that get him
you
right.
Didn't like Tommy Lee Jones.
Stop.
No,
I hate
we are,
you.
No.
Ruined
Wait,
it.
No, he wasn't Joker. He was Scarface.
Yeah.
Right. Not Scarface.
But you, we've
Guys,
seen like a
I'm
high
failing.
Bar.
He's failing.
We're going to kick you out of the club
yes.
of the DC villains.
Joker, you have to understand these layers of villainy
okay.
in order to play him and understand
but
him,
there's another like. Thing that Joker brings up another point of what I like about villains, and I would argue that Magneto and Professor X bring it up too, which is that we often talk erroneously about love interests being like two halves of a whole, and I don't believe that. I believe that that's not the correct definition for romance, but it is the correct definition for heroes and villains. The heroes and villains should feel like two halves of the same conversation,
mm-hmm.
and the fact is, the thing that makes Joker so interesting is that he's a reaction to Batman.
Yes.
Batman is a control freak.
Mm-hmm.
He's so afraid of chaos. And so what kind of antagonist do you give a character like Batman? You give him an avatar of chaos.
Yeah.
You have Professor X and Magneto, who exist on completely opposite sides of essentially a debate.
Right, an intellectual.
An intellectual debate. And so I do think that we should remember that heroes and villains are always in direct conversation with each other.
And that makes for the greatest sort of friction. And
yeah.
that's why, yes, Voldemort and Harry were linked because...
Sure.
He's the Horcrux he never
I
meant
mean, they're
to make.
Extremes, yeah.
But I just didn't feel like they were foils.
This is what happens when it doesn't feel like two halves of a conversation, but it instead feels like a pillar
yes.
and a person passing by it.
Right. And I just think that villains, for me, if I stay with your work, I'm there actually for your antagonist.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I like your hero, but I'm there for the big baddie,
yeah.
right? I want to know who's going to destroy the world. It's just like the Night King... In
Game of Thrones
is not scary to me.
No.
He's not scary at all.
He looks scary.
Because there's no tension anymore.
No,
because I'm like, you want to make Endless Night for what? What are we going to do? If I join you, what am we going to do?
Where's
night?
What happens after?
Right.
You don't like being cold.
I love being cold. I don't like being hot. But I'll join your endless night and your endless winter. But what are we going to be doing?
I don't want to be an ice person.
I like a little cold. I've always
yeah.
liked it cold. So I will join you. What are we going to do?
What's next?
What's next?
And when
next?
You feel like truly the villainous ambition ends, by the end of the book, then it doesn't really excite it. And I mean, I've played with that concept in something like the villain series, where my villain slash hero truly has an existential crisis because the only thing he's ever planned for is bringing down his enemy, and then kind of does and is faced with the, oh God, like, who am I now without revenge?
I feel like there's a moment in all villains where they reach that point. And that's the moment where they no longer become interesting. Yeah. And one of the examples is, I feel, Lucifer in Supernatural. He's no longer scary. He's a joke. And I feel
that's
like...
That's the worst thing you can do as a storyteller.
Oh, and you lose it. You lose all the tension.
And then at the end of the thing, I'm just like, I don't care about this angry white man who was seduced by the devil. Lucifer in, you know, in the original story... I sympathize. I would have joined.
Oh, absolutely.
Humans are terrible. Why
also,
would you choose them over us, angels?
Early seasons of Supernatural were really good at villainy.
Yes.
Were very, because they did my favorite thing, which was turn villainy into an inner demon that exists within our heroes.
Yes.
And anytime you can make villainy an internal thing, I love that.
Right. It just makes it scarier.
Oh, it's so much scarier because it feels close. It feels... inevitable.
And living in your house with you.
Yeah. It's a shadow.
And
I loved Dexter's dark passenger
absolutely.
In that way, who was not another character at all, but this other facet of Dexter.
I'm excited for a show called Prodigal Son.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen the previews for it. It's about he's a detective and crime scene expert, but his father is a serial killer and the most famous serial killer.
Oh, nice.
And he's like, you are me. And I am you.
Yeah.
And he's raised by a serial killer, and he had no idea that his dad was killing people. And so it's about, am I my father? And he can understand how every crime scene is made. He can redo the murder. And it's
I saw a preview of that. Yeah.
It looks
it's
so
a little
good.
Bit in talking about conversations and having that close relationship. I mean, it's the thing that makes Hannibal interesting.
Yes.
It's the thing that makes Villanelle in Killing Eve interesting. Because the proximity... That is one of the hottest villains I've ever seen.
I'm like, you can kill me, but can we have fun first?
I know, right?
So I can go out, like, on death.
Yeah.
I'm really easy. I really love hot villains. Like,
that's why Magneto will get you.
Absolutely.
I mean, Magneto is a good-looking...
Good-looking.
I mean, young Magneto.
I love a good, complicated person.
Like, Angel turns bad.
Oh, we all love that, though.
Right.
There's nothing sexier than a villain that didn't start out that way.
That's right.
Like, there's nothing cooler and nothing more exciting for me as a creator than making a villain out of a hero.
Right. And seeing that sort of descent. Because I do think that every hero has the capacity to fall.
Absolutely.
And I love that. Because I want to know the bruise that would push them over the edge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a Catholic, I really love the fall of people.
Yeah.
I love that story part.
But I want you to believe that people can fall, but also that people can rise. So that way you trust nobody's place.
Right.
Yeah.
Ooh. And it makes it stressful because then you look at villains and you're like, okay, there are so many different shades of it, right? And... It's a good pun, right?
Yeah.
Shades.
Oh, yeah.
The shades of magic.
I know.
But no, I was thinking about if we were to create a chart, and at some point I want to do this, where... A villain chart, where we have the different shades of villainry from, like, sort of light. And
I did this. I did this with my college thesis.
Okay,
I'll break it down. I'll send it to you.
It's fascinating.
I ranked, I think, 100 heroes and 100 villains along an axis.
Yes.
Like an axis of, you know, a positive axis, negative axis. And the positive axis was, for on the heroes chart, hero. And the negative axis was anti-hero. And then on the villains, positive was anti-villain and negative was villain. It is fascinating when you start going through pop culture and assessing.
It's really interesting to me the characteristics that we ascribe to heroes. For instance, I was listening to Song of Achilles.
Yeah.
And one
she
of the,
cried.
I, as you should.
I was weeping on the 6th train going
as you
home when Patroclus dies. And I had gone through, we did the Odyssey in school, but we didn't do the Iliad. So I was like, Patroclus, that's his best friend. Oh, wait. Obviously it's his boyfriend.
Clearly.
Yeah, clearly. And so I think that we're looking, Achilles is a villain. He's a villain at the end of the Trojan War because he refuses to fight until his lover is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But he is all of the characteristics are supposed to be the peak Greek hero.
Yes.
And these are all of
the archetype.
All of these archetypes. And it's the same thing with Captain America. Captain America has all of these qualities. He was engineered to be a hero. And so when he turns against this thing because he believes that choice and freedom are being taken away, he falls.
Right.
Yep.
Right? But he's still doing the good thing.
That's my favorite thing, is that we realize that hero and villain are just loaded terms that don't actually apply universally to characters.
Right.
And it's fascinating, too, thinking about what it takes for someone to become a villain and what it takes for someone to be a hero.
What would it take for you to become a villain?
I'm a villain. People don't really realize that because I like to have my Hufflepuff veneer, but I have always been a villain.
I've known you were always a villain.
I'm always a villain. So
we're just sitting here trying to drag you down, Soraya.
Exactly.
Like, we're the anchors.
I'm a Gryffindor.
We are the weights on your feet.
But Gryffindors can have tendencies.
You're reckless.
To be, we're reckless.
Right.
And we can hurt people.
I just know that if a Gryffindor comes for me, you better not miss. Because I am a Slytherin, and I will wait until you have forgotten. And then send that snake in those pipes. That's right. And so that's what the Gryffindors. I'm like, be careful when you march into battle and you wield that sword of Gryffindor. Because if you don't take off my head, I'm coming for you. I'm going to grow a lot of other ones.
You're terrifying. You're the most terrifying little person I've ever met.
Look, I was...
I know. Somebody came for me on the internet the other day. They were like, I thought you were tall. And I was like...
And then I came into your mentions.
Excuse me.
Right. I came into your mentions and
villainy
I said...
Villainy comes in all sizes.
Exactly. I said, we are small.
Villainy comes in all sizes.
I said, we are small, wee monsters.
Yes.
And yeah.
Call me small again.
I feel like
happens.
For me, it would take you fuck with somebody I love.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that the problem with Gryffindors is, like, you don't always look at the greater world. I feel like you would protect...
Your circle.
Your circle.
Yeah.
Right, and forsake... the bigger world.
I protect my ambition. I protect my interests. I protect my people. I think it's a different hardwiring. And so for me to become a villain, it actually wouldn't take much because you press certain buttons and I'm going to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My mom always called me sort of like a little teapot. Like, the water's always a little bit warm in there.
I know.
And that's basically why. But she said that it took 2 seconds to heat me up and bubble over and explode.
Tempers.
And so I have a temper.
Small people have tempers.
Exactly. So it actually wouldn't take me much. I really am drawn to more villains than I am to heroes because I like complicated people who don't always do the right
thing. But I would argue that's just a sign that the heroes aren't being well written.
That's very true.
You know,
that's
like
true.
I think that a complicated hero can be really, really interesting. I think so often we don't work as hard on our heroes because we think it's easier to be good than bad when the exact opposite is true.
I would love to see that done, though. The hero that's, I don't know.
Read my books.
Yes, read your books.
Lila Bard is
definitely. But at first, when I first met Lila Bard, I thought she was a villain.
Yeah.
I immediately thought, oh, this bitch is about to really cut some people
Which
in here.
She did.
And she did. And I was like, but then you showed a little bit of her cracks.
Yeah.
And I think when we talk about humanizing characters and villains, showing that tiny crack that
I
keeps
find
rippling
people
out.
Without cracks so boring.
So
because
boring.
Also, what do we have as readers to latch onto? I mean, we don't see ourselves in other people's strengths. We see ourselves in other people's weaknesses.
Right. I don't want to read about a perfect character
well,
or
we just,
sugar and spice
we don't,
everything
we
nice.
We don't relate
I
to it.
That's why one of the... Since we're all YA writers, one of the things that I particularly hate is when people say that a girl character is boring or... is she
Mary
boring
Sue.
And a Mary Sue or she is
likable. I only want to read about
unlikable
girls.
So the problem is what people mean sometimes when they say unlikable is unrelatable. And that cracks, like, that cuts into a question of are we having your character make choices which are conceivable? And so I always, whenever I hear the term unlikable, I always want to dive deeper and see, is it because I don't get why she's doing the things that she's doing?
Right. Do you think that, I feel like sometimes women are more forgiving of men who are unlikable?
Oh, absolutely,
absolutely.
Absolutely. The only people who have ever told me that they felt Delilah Bard deserved to die for how reckless her character was, like that she should have died by the end of the series, spoiler, she doesn't, were women. We
They're
have
in the
so much,
place. That
so much self-loathing.
Soaked in the patriarchal bullshit. And also, I think women can be tools of patriarchal violence.
Absolutely.
I say it a lot. And
Absolutely.
I think that we don't give women content creators or female characters enough space to make mistakes, especially teen girls. They're supposed to have all shit
also,
figured out.
Also, to be fair, like, so I write very specifically when I write YA, just as when I write any category for a version of myself, and I'm specifically writing at all times to 17-year-old me.
Yeah.
17-year-old me would have burned the world down to be happy. Like, literally does not understand this notion of, like, giving a young female character power and then expecting her to be selfless about it.
Yeah, no.
17-year-old me was having none of that. 17-year-old me did not understand the idea of self-sacrifice because I was so miserable and sad right. and angry that I would have... I mean, I was absolutely a villain at 17.
Can you imagine if we were together in high school?
You guys would not have been friends with me.
No.
Probably not. You were too nice.
But she and I would have been like,
oh, I was
going to
say, Danielle and I would have been.
And it's like, oh.
Friends. We might have chosen to like try and convert you the way we have very slowly tried now in our adulthood.
You've gotten pettier.
I have always been petty.
But
you're
so tolerant. You go to the sad place inside.
I have worked for 10 years at a New York City club, and that pulled me into one of the darkest places of my life, and I came out of that, and I am now a more calmer,
you are
happier person.
We want to see you rage.
I feel like I went through like my rage and awful phase. Like there are so many times where I should have been killed in my life because I put myself in dangerous situations.
Okay, but I do feel like your listeners need to know that you do something very specific when you hit the rage place around us, where you go to another realm behind your eyes and your entire face becomes like a mask of complacency, and behind there you're clearly like escaping through a doorway into a magical land of
Fairyland.
Mermen and like pretty images. I feel like you like escape, whereas like Danielle and I engage instantly with anything that makes us mad.
I call that, for all the listeners out there, I call that my emotional blackout.
It's the most fascinating thing. I witnessed it for the first time this summer, and I literally looked at Danielle and I was like, is something wrong? Because you just were not home.
Right.
Your eyes like took on a glassy tone and you went somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's a coping.
I have learned to taper down my violent impulses.
Right. By going to a place of mermen. And
Versus Victoria and I take out our knives.
Oh, yeah.
Like immediately.
I once carved a line in the table.
I will pick up the sword again.
Yes.
For the right causes.
For the right causes.
But you're right. Probably in our teen years.
Yes.
Danielle and I definitely would have run in the Mean Girls pack together.
Absolutely.
Like the outsider Mean Girls, not the Regina George Mean Girls. Yeah. But I feel like I would have looked at you and thought to myself, I can turn her.
Yes. Just like the vampire. Yes.
Exactly. I can turn you.
Just a few bites.
I like taking the nice ones and just seeing if I can corrupt a little bit.
And she's like a secret. You have a secret other side. And it's interesting. And that's something else, too, about villains and heroes that I like to see.
Way to bring it back around.
Yeah. Like what they face the world with versus what they have internally and what we get to see. And that's fascinating to me when those are in conflict.
Absolutely.
And that's, for me, what makes for a good villain. And when I was building my villain in The Bells, Sophia, I always thought, why don't I just write the book from her point of view? But I thought she would be much more, or show her in the book, she would be much more terrifying to see what she's done.
Yeah.
Where she actually looks quite rational at first, just a little quirky, just a little strange. Everyone likes what they like.
Mm-hmm.
But what if I just kept creating cracks in her sort of perfect veneer over time?
Well, so I just watched The Boys, which is an Amazon show, and it is about superheroes, but it's about corporatized superheroes, and there is a fascinating thing because when you first engage with the superheroes in the show, they look and seem like superheroes, and then they begin to unravel in front of you into very, very messed up people. I love that.
I love it.
More than anything else. I love watching a composure fracture and unravel.
And it just, like a ball of yarn, it starts to just entangle and knot, and then they get angry.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're plotting correctly, you unravel them and then you complicate them to try to put themselves back together.
Yeah.
You don't allow for such things. And that's my favorite thing. So how do you build your villains?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do what you do? All of you.
I feel like
both
my villains are generally in the background. For The Vicious Deep, it was a very ambitious, scorned mermaid.
And scorn can get you a
and
lot.
And she's like, I will just... But
nothing worse than a scorned woman.
She had a reason. She, you know, like her father cast her out and took away her right to the throne.
So you gave her something to be angry about.
Right.
A breeze.
And she's like, if I can't have the oceans and the world, like, I will destroy it.
Right.
And for Labyrinth Lost, the villain is this woman called the Devourer, and she has the opposite powers of Alex, which Alex is an enchantress, so she has all the powers of the gods, or she can access all the powers of the gods. But that can lead to madness.
Right,
and
she's a conduit.
So the Devourer is literally her foil, and it's like what she could become if she
lets
everything go.
Which I love, because I was a kid that wanted to let it all go. Mm-hmm. I would have let it go.
Yeah.
I don't have the self-control.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that my problem when I'm creating villains is that I would rather stay with my broken heroes.
You love a good broken bird.
I do love broken birds. Mm-hmm. I just want to fix you.
Also, the men out here.
I write my villains the same way I write everybody else, which is I put the exact same amount of work into making all of the characters flawed so that over the course of a narrative, it can be difficult to determine which one's the villain.
Right.
Like, that's what excites me.
I think that you have to be able to ask yourself when you're drafting is, what does everyone in your book want?
Yeah.
Right.
And if you can't answer that question, then your villain is probably two-dimensional.
That's what I say. So the questions that I ask every single character that I build, because I want them to all have that kind of gray zone complexity, is what do they fear? What do they want? And what are they willing to do to get what they want?
Yep. Right. Absolutely.
And it's interesting, too. So for my first series, Tiny Pretty Things, you've got three girls. One is a clear-cut villain. One is the good girl, the clear-cut hero, and the other one is a mix. She's more like Iago, where she does villainous things but thinks that she's doing them for the right reason.
Yeah.
But then by the end, they're all villains. Mm-hmm. And some readers hate that. They're like, wait, there's not one. They all made mistakes. They're all
That's
messing with each other.
Being people.
Right. And I wanted to break down the one girl that you think is the mean girl. Yeah, she's mean. And she does things. She has reasons for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you might actually agree with her at the end.
But that's just, I like making readers question their own morals. That's one of my favorite things to do.
Like, would you do that?
Yeah.
And then with Sophia in The Bells, I just wanted to take this idea of, if you can have everything and be the most beautiful woman in the world, and that's what you want, what are you willing to do to everyone around you in order to get that thing?
Exactly.
And then you've got her foil, which is Camille, who is ambitious and wants to be able to make the most beautiful people in the world. So they have the same goal.
They have the
same
goal, yeah.
Right.
Usually for mine, there's a combination of ambition and loneliness.
Right.
And so, like, there are not many people that you wouldn't cut down because there are not many people that you care about. And so it's about, when I create those characters out of those three pillars, I then try to give them a mantra.
Right.
And then over the course of the narrative, I try and make them break their own mantra. So I put stress upon them. Maybe I introduce people when they think they don't care about anybody. Maybe I, you know, I do whatever I can to lean against whatever it is they believe about themselves.
And break,
exactly.
Break those bones. And it's a fascinating sort of exercise to, like, how do I break everything you said you love? It's torture.
Yeah.
This is what we do. I do have a question about villains in general, because in all of the examples that we've talked about and more examples, why don't villains have partners? I mean, like, where's Voldemort's wife? Like,
well,
where's, like, do you know what I mean?
Play.
Or husband? Well, I haven't seen the play, so don't spoil it. But I mean, in general, why are villains usually lone actors, lone wolves? I'm fascinated in villains that have groups.
Because they're selfish. Because they have, like, worshippers, but they don't have partners.
Right. Wouldn't it be interesting, though?
Like, I want to see more of those dynamics where it's like, we're going to be evil together, but at a certain point,
one always is willing to go farther than the other. And
so
that's what's interesting to me. It's not that they can't start out with partners, but eventually the line between those two becomes who is willing to go farther.
Because my mom used to always say to me, like, when we would see, you know, pictures from, like, the 1960s about with the KKK, with the hoods, my mom would say, those men go home and lay down next to their wives.
Yeah.
And the most interesting thing for me is that wife.
Yep.
And I want to know how partners sort of engage
in partners become enablers. Right. Right. One is usually the enabler of the other's ambitions. And it's not that I don't think you can have equals, but I do think that one of the pressure forces in those things is the fact that one is always willing to go further, one always wants more, and the other is usually willing to enable. And that's how you either have villains who start as partners and break apart and become adversaries in
which
their
is
own
great.
Right. Yeah.
Well, also, when you have villains who do love something and that is their weakness and that's the thing that they might sacrifice everything over.
Yeah.
Like if you look at Six of Crows, Kaz has an edge, and
right.
Kaz is a villain.
Yeah.
But he doesn't do the right thing. He does the thing that's convenient for him.
Yeah.
But in our eyes, we're looking for reasons to make
care.
Him a hero.
Yeah.
Because of programming.
But over and over again, he tells you, "I'm not a hero. I am a villain." And
we don't believe him.
And we don't believe him. We don't want to believe him.
Because we don't want to believe him.
Absolutely not. Because he will do whatever it takes to come back to you and to save you. But does he do that for everybody, or does he do that because it is the thing that is going to get him his money or his goal or his whatever?
I mean, that's the great
question.
But then
you look at the other characters in the series, like Weiland's dad,
mm-hmm.
Jean Van Eck, he doesn't love anything. He loves power.
So far less interesting.
He's far less interesting.
Well, we like caveats.
Yeah.
Right.
Because those caveats and those people become the cracks that we can exploit, the cracks that readers are going to hope for, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. And it makes them just so much more interesting. I mean, again, it's my beef with the Night King and Voldemort. They were never scary to me because I'm like, you haven't given me the stakes of why.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm going to live forever. Where's your wife or your husband to live forever with? You're going to be by yourself? Or your followers? But your followers are going to die because they're also not going to be able to live forever because you want to be the only one. So
I think the theme we see again and again is that villainy is lonely.
I want to know if I'm going to be a villain and I can have a villain
boo. No.
Can I have a villain boo? You're trying to take this away from me.
You can have villain worshippers and you can have, like...
You can have a villain lover.
Yeah, you can have villain
lovers,
but you're not going to have a villain equal. Because think about what that means. Like, in order for you to have a villain equal, you have to be okay with somebody else being on the same level that you are. And I don't think that most of us who style ourselves the antagonists of the narrative are okay.
Why am I single? Also, Danielle.
I will stab you if you get too close to my level.
Yes!
But I think that's the problem. I think you have to, like, ask yourself, what do you want? Like, what would you be willing to give up to have an equal? Would you be willing to share that space?
Well, can't I just be villainous over my own city and he can be villainous over his city, or she can be villainous over hers, and then we just, like, meet in the middle?
No, that's, like, not villains then. Like, that's you living in separate worlds. How are you going to coexist? Okay, someone who makes me think about this a lot, and it's one of the only times we see villains with partners, Fisk.
Oh.
Fisk in Daredevil.
Right.
Yes.
And his partner is an equal.
It is one of the most terrifying. So I actually tweeted about this because an editor at Del Rey was rewatching Daredevil, and he was like, well, that opening
Vanessa.
Scene for Fisk is one of the most beautiful, haunting moments where he's staring at this painting and he's, like, talking about loneliness.
Yeah.
And I think that we come back to the same thing that you were saying, which is, like, that loneliness aspect. And he does sacrifice everything for her, and she goes along with him.
But this is the best thing about Vanessa and Fisk, is that we meet Vanessa and we expect her to be a damsel, and we expect her to be entering into this relationship with him because she doesn't know better. And so we expect that when she sees his true self, she's going to flee like damsels do. We see this as, like, a Beauty and the Beast moment. Instead, what it is she has absolutely pegged him for who he is, and she likes him for
that. She's here for it.
She's here for it. So I would counter your no villains get to have partners with Vanessa is one of the most interesting partners.
I wish we saw more of that in books. I mean, that is something that I'm looking
for.
Do you think that because we write YA, we're not allowed to have that?
Speak for yourselves, bitches.
Yeah, I know, right? It's true, though. It's something I want to challenge myself with my writing to see how I can play with power.
Well, and I just watched The Politician, which just came out, this TV show on Netflix that's starring Ben Platt. I can never remember if it's an L or an R. And they are, like, it's about a group of high school politicians at an uber ambitious school that basically he wants to go on to become president of the United States. And it's about the people who surround him. Now, like,
are they sycophants or
are they... No, they are like basically like they have decided they want to be the chiefs of staff of the future president of the United States. It's a very ambitious school. Trigger warning. There is suicide in the very first episode. Okay. It made me aggressively uncomfortable, but the rest of the show was captivating enough that I pressed through, and I'm really glad I did, because talk about a show entirely made of anti-heroes.
I love it. And that's, I'm more interested in that. And also, what makes you the villain's henchman? Yeah. Right? What kind of
and personality? And these people did not want to be the villain or the hero. They wanted the space behind the throne. They wanted this to sit at either side. But to the point of, like, his high school girlfriend, the main character's high school girlfriend, wants to be the First Lady of the United States. And everything is a curation. And, like, his chiefs of staff of, like, the senior year of high school want to be the chiefs of staff. Like, this is a long con towards the presidency that starts at 17. It is fascinating.
That's fascinating to me, because I'm curious about what makes you the master of whisperers. What makes you the king's the spider. Hand. Because I don't want to be the king's hand, because I know that I'm going to be killed.
Some people do.
It's a risky position.
They want to be the power behind the throne, though. And you think about it, though, look at somebody like the master of whispers or the spider. They can move to wherever it suits them, so they're not tied to one villain.
Right.
And that's a really interesting flux role.
It's a risk,
so they, because they ally themselves where the power is. But exactly.
And that makes for the loyalty issues. So but, I might cut your head off if
well, that is a
me.
Thing that gets explored over the course of the show.
Right. Ugh, I need to watch this. It's going to make
I watched it in like 2 days. I'm not going to lie. It's like 8 episodes. I binged it.
No, I'm going to.
But
gonna
I do out. Wish I had had a. I wish I had had a warning. Like, there is a queer character killed in the first episode. What I will say is that it is not the only queer character in the show, which makes me very happy. And one of the standout stars of the show is a young trans actor named Theo Germain, I believe. Just an absolute star. Like, they were incredible.
That's amazing.
And their identity is not part of the story at all. Perfect. Like, the fact that they are trans has nothing to do with the story.
Great. I love it. I'm excited for us moving towards that. It does make me wonder and think about who gets to be a villain.
Yes. And oh, well, I will argue there are both male and female villains in The Politician.
That's good, because I do find it to be...
I would argue every character on that show at some point is the villain of the narrative.
Which is great, because I want to see the idea of a villain open up. Of course. In Aquaman, there are two villains, right? There's... Aquaman's foil, which is his half-brother. He's your classic, I'm a beautiful white man, and I deserve the throne, and you're threatening me.
Yeah.
You brown, half, you know, beautiful man are threatening me. But then you've got this, like, angered black man named Manta who's like, you killed my dad, and you made me feel like a little man, so I'm going to chase you around the seas, and I'm going to, like, murder you. He's a laughingstock.
Uh-huh.
I know they were probably trying to go for, like, a Killmonger, but no one can be Killmonger.
Well, interestingly, Hobbs and Shaw is a super flawed movie, but Idris Elba as a villain is beautiful to look at. And, like...
I just want the space to be able to create a black villain without...
I want us to be able to have queer villains. And the fact is, we can't have queer villains until we have enough queer characters in the story. Yeah, or queer, like... middlemen as well. I want queer heroes, queer middlemen, queer villains. But as with any marginalization, until we no longer have a dearth of those characters on screen or on page, it makes it really hard for them to operate in multiple roles, especially because we usually get one.
One.
And when you get one character in a cast, then you're kind of stuck on what to do with them. Right. And so I've seen a lot of uproar about something like The Politician. And yes, it is a really painful scene to watch. And I'm sad that it was a queer character. Their queerness wasn't the reason, I don't believe. It doesn't seem like that they committed suicide, but I also was so relieved to find that they were not the only queer representation on that show, because that was a relief.
And it's tough because a lot of people die in my Bell's world.
Well, this
and
is
one
also
of
the
my
hard
characters
thing.
Died, and people were mad about it. And I was like, she died because she didn't follow instructions.
This is the hard thing as well, in that, like, where there's an aspect of reality here, which that lives are harder for those in marginalizations. Yes. And I usually come very strongly down on the side of, like, dude, just let them live.
Right.
Like, I will kill all of the straight white characters in my stories first, or I will be far more loath to kill queer characters and characters of color, because... I've just seen enough of it, and I'm tired. And there are some really, really amazing stories out there, but I personally, that's just not a thing that I feel like I need more of right now.
Yeah, I just, in my world is post-homophobia, so I'm like, you all can die. And it's terrible, but you're right. We need to think about making sure that there are lots of other kinds of characters that survive.
Yeah.
And that's why I like to populate my world with all different kinds, but I do feel afraid to write villains of color. And I'm going to push through that and write a villain who is, she's just awful.
Yeah.
Because those are the fun characters to write, damn it.
Well, and the problem is also, if the characters aren't well enough written, we begin to equate their marginalizations with their villainy. But I think if there's enough dimension to the character, it makes that very lazy argument harder to do.
Right.
So, last thing, what's your favorite villain? You get one.
No!
Yes!
No!
Or maybe two. I'm taking Magneto again.
No, come on.
You didn't shoot him.
We said Magneto before this started.
I know.
Okay, fine. I'm going first then. Dolores Umbridge.
Okay. Books or movies?
Any, all, both.
Oh, this is really difficult. You should go.
Well, I love Magneto. I love Bellatrix Lestrange, who I brought up before.
That's it. You said one.
You
or
said
two.
You can't be keeping multiple villains. Stop listing new ones.
Fine. Add some. You're not going to add the ones that I'm going to add.
You can come back around. It can be your turn again.
Yes. See, that's why you can't set these rules.
All right. Wait, Sarita.
This is what happens when I play Uno. I break the rules.
It already fell out of my head. I feel... Okay, so I have Faith from Buffy.
Okay.
I think that she was really wonderful. Okay. And she brought out a lot of darkness within Buffy and a lot of the questions that she had about being a Slayer that I feel like were not really dealt with. And it sort of try to transform her character. Obviously, you know, it's still like Joss Whedon feminism, but I really love her as a character. But my problem is that when you have a fantastic female villain, the goal is to neuter her and to make her a good person at the end.
Yeah.
Right. It's like Regina from Once Upon a Time. By the end of that show, they completely neuter her. They like take away everything that makes her compelling and sexy, and they're like,
ambitious.
Well, I'm a hero now. I'm gonna do the right thing for no reason.
Well, women aren't allowed to be aggressively
not without being castrated in some way.
Yeah, and they take everything away. They gave her a bad haircut. Like, they start dressing her differently. Like, and they do
the same
thing.
They want you to love her. They just want you to love her. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
They do the same thing to Captain Hook. They're like, we're gonna take away too much leather. And I'm like, bro.
Captain Hook is awful.
Shut up.
I hate him. I hate him. I don't think he's scary.
Are we only talking about Once Upon a Time iterations or what?
No, I'm talking about Hook. I'm talking about Hook.
From
the original Rufio.
No, you shut your face.
You're talking about the Robin Williams Hook adaptation?
That's not the original.
Sorry. Whatever. It's racist. So I'm not interested in Peter at all. And he was never scary to me, so...
Of course he's not scary.
That damn crocodile.
I'm talking about Hook from... Captain Hook, Killian Jones from Once Upon a Time.
He's just sexy.
That's true, exactly.
Wait, I have a villain that's also a hero. And that is the lead in Peaky Blinders.
Ooh.
I haven't seen that.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
Well, I only know him as Killian Murphy because I can't remember anyone's character name. But talk about a character who goes through complete arcs... in very, very interesting ways. No, mine is Dolores Umbridge, I think, without question.
I do love Anakin Skywalker in the... not so much Darth Vader. I feel like Darth Vader never scared me.
Luke, I am your father.
That was a terrible...
I tried.
But I loved Anakin because we saw his trauma.
Flirted.
We saw him lose. As opposed to, you know,
Don't
Kylo.
Bring up Kylo because his... No.
Guys, I...
No, his fans.
I won't.
I like Kylo.
What?
I like Kylo.
He's a lonely, sad boy.
I was going to say, because he's basically like an immature, like he has such a temper tantrum.
But he's not scary.
I don't like him because he's scary. I don't think he's scary. I think he's a really interesting antagonist.
I would just laugh at him and he would kill me.
Yeah, probably, but that's something to be said about, like, I think I like him because that's a very grounded kind of villainy. He's an insecure,
so insecure,
temper tantrum-y child, and the fact is that's far more relatable as a human being than Darth Vader.
He's just not a formidable adversary
to
my girl.
You don't know that.
They're going to come for me. Okay, this is not going to start into a Star Wars podcast, but I do think that, like, they are opposite sides.
Yes.
They are absolutely two sides of power. And it is.
I want her to have to face somebody bigger and badder.
Talking about heroes and villains in conversation, those two characters exist in a direct dialogue with each other.
She's not spoiled.
And also, though, she is absolutely an avatar of the dark side. Yes. There's no way you get called to the dark side that easily, so instantly, when she, like, dives in head first.
But that would be me.
That's what I'm saying. But I'm saying I've always seen her as, like, the bad one.
I think she is the one who can wield both the dark side and the light side. Yeah. I think that she is, like, that.
But I think Kylo is really interesting in conversation with her.
In conversation with her, but also, like, you killed Han Solo, don't talk to me.
Right. Look.
Okay.
Okay. Now I think Adam Driver's stands are gonna flood our mentions.
I know. Twitter. Adam Driver is a fantastic actor.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He's so good at everything. Like everything he's in, he's just like he goes into that mode, and he's wonderful. But I do think that like between Kylo and Anakin, I love Anakin, especially if you watch. Not the prequels, but if you watch the Clone Wars, the TV show, I feel like the way that they develop him and they bring out everything that happens to him to pull out his insecurities, the loss of his mother, people not really...
Ooh!
You're such a troll.
Okay, I have one last one that is, he's a hero, but I think he's a villain at the same time. Gambit from X-Men.
Yeah.
From the TV show?
No, he shows up. I read all the comics as a kid, and then he shows up in some of the films slightly, but he is.
Where is he in the films?
He shows up in one of the X-Men when they go to Louisiana. They're searching for.
Oh my God,
yeah, they like planted him in that movie, and then they never used him again.
Exactly. But he was my favorite. I grew up reading all of his comic books.
I love
him because he's like, I'll be a hero today.
Yeah.
But you make me mad. And you'll meet a villain.
Okay, wait.
Those are my
favorites. I have another villain, and I feel like it really embodies everything we've been talking about in terms of the kinds of characters that have really grounded backstories and that are believable. Michael Keaton's Vulture from Spider-Man Homecoming, the dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Because that is somebody who we understand from the moment we meet him why he becomes a villain, and it's a slow, it's not one step. It's like seven steps toward villainy.
And that's the thing that you were talking about, the KKK, and like that man goes home and he has a family.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. See, that's another example of somebody. But the difference is that Michael Keaton's family is not aware who he is.
Yes.
Right.
And the scene where he's driving them to prom has so much tension. I always like feel
so
like
much.
Stressful.
I love
that
scene
because
so much.
He knows what's happening.
To hold it in the Spider-Verse for a second, the uncle in Into the Spider-Verse.
Yes.
Talk about a character that, like, is a matter of perspective,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I was just like,
I was
oh,
wrecked.
No.
I was wrecked.
Oh, no. Uncle
but
Aaron,
so I think what we love, are villains that tap in
to the humanity.
What
about in books, though?
I love the Darkling. I love that he doesn't get turned into a hero.
Yes.
I love that the Darkling is always and forever a villain.
He's always a forever villain.
I appreciate that so
and
much.
And I do. I loved Alina's draw to him because she was drawn to her own power. Also, a Kylo.
Yeah,
and,
but I'm forgetting
Rey
the name now
because
it's been several years since I read it. But in Fire. Christine Cashore's Fire.
Oh, what's
the
that
villain? The guy.
Name? Yeah.
He is basically. Christine Cashore is amazing at heroes and villains, and there's a couple villains in her series who are. It's a single syllable. I'm going to remember it as soon as we're done here. He has a terrible grace.
Right.
Like, he has a horrific grace power.
Which is amazing.
I know.
It's so amazing.
But I love a good manipulative villain.
I love Jude Duarte from
Cruel
Prince.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, Holly Black's villains are always top-notch. Because
she's the heroine of the book. But she does...
I'm reading Queen of Nothing right now, and I'm just like...
Fuck you!
Oh! I know.
Get out of my
office. That's probably the most amazing way to end our episode.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us, Victoria.
Of course.
We do love you.
Even though I've been verbally harassed and undermined and poked
what
and prodded.
What would you expect from visiting your close friends
in
Deadline City?
Yeah, so thank you guys so much for listening. Check out our Patreon. Rate, subscribe, all of that good stuff. tweet at us, tell us what you think about who your favorite villains are, and we will see you next week.
Better say my characters.
Absolutely. Victor!